Hello and welcome to Science World.
We haven't yet quite found Earth 2.0. We're not quite there yet, but we can almost taste it. It seems that it's, from what we now know, quite inevitable that there will be Earth analogs out there.
Is there life somewhere out there in the cosmos? We talk with Dr. Jill Tarter at the SETI Institute about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. A private aerospace company called SpaceX again postpones their rocket flight to the International Space Station. And Steve Barragona tells us how U.S. farmers are using sophisticated GPS technology to use less fertilizer, save money, and protect the environment. We have these stories and more coming up for you on VOA Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. A private company called SpaceX plans to attempt something that has only been accomplished by governments, sending a spacecraft up to the International Space Station, or ISS. But SpaceX issued a statement on Wednesday saying that the May 7th launch to the ISS had to be postponed, adding that SpaceX is, quote, continuing to work through the software assurance process with NASA, unquote. Suzanne Presto reports that a new launch date has not been set.
If all goes according to plan, SpaceX's Falcon 9 rocket, carrying its unmanned Dragon capsule, will lift off from Cape Canaveral in Florida. Then the cargo-carrying spacecraft will journey toward the International Space Station, where it will dock if all goes well. It is the first time a private company will attempt such a mission. This demonstration launch had been targeted for November 2011, then rescheduled multiple times this year. Elon Musk, the chief executive officer at SpaceX, said at a NASA news briefing last month that many things can go wrong with such complex, relatively new technologies. He said the biggest challenges have been related to Dragon's planned proximity and berthing operations with the space station, and he said software testing has been the main cause of delays.
Does the software always do the right thing in a particular circumstance? And when you've got 18 engines and you've got sort of 6 flight computers and a whole bunch of other systems, just the test matrix of that is enormous.
Musk said the Falcon 9 rocket, which has been tested twice, is not the issue. Nor are the elements of the Dragon spacecraft that were tested during its orbital mission in 2010, such as its thrusters, heat shield, and parachutes. He emphasized that Dragon is an autonomous robotic spaceship, and that berthing with the space station is a complicated maneuver.
It's not as though there's somebody flying it with a joystick, or that there's somebody on board that can make kind of real-time corrections. Dragon is making lots of decisions all the time to optimize the probability of success. So there's a lot of intelligence on board the spacecraft, and all of that has to be tested thoroughly, and that's the biggest driver of the timeline.
SpaceX made history when it successfully tested its Falcon 9 rocket and Dragon capsule in December 2010. It is the only commercial company to re-enter a spacecraft from Earth orbit. But the next step is for the reusable Dragon to make it to the space station, which is zooming around the Earth every 90 minutes. The station is well-stocked, so there are no concerns if the astronauts do not get the cargo on this demonstration flight. To date, NASA has invested $381 million in SpaceX's commercial cargo capabilities. The U.S. Space Agency is investing in commercial companies to handle low Earth orbit transportation so NASA can focus on the next generation of spacecraft that can go deeper into space. Suzanne Presto, VOA News, Washington.
Maternal health care is improving in rural Nigeria thanks to a program to expand the use of midwives. The program could serve as a model for other developing countries. Joe DeCapua reports.
It's called the Midwife Service Scheme, and it's a year old. National coordinator Dr. Ugo Okoli says the program takes advantage of a large pool of skilled women.
Nigeria actually has a lot of midwives on their register. So when you go to the Nursing and Midwifery Council, where the midwives register, get their licenses and all that, they actually do have quite a number of midwives registered there. But the issues we have is, where are they working?
Most were not working in rural areas.
A lot of them actually work in the city centers, in general hospitals, in teaching hospitals, whilst not a lot of them are working in the rural areas, the primary healthcare centers where we actually need them.
Dr. Accoli says the concentration of midwives in urban areas meant rural pregnant women were not receiving the best care.
The problem is we end up having a cadre of workers that we call community health workers, community health practitioners, who are not as well trained as midwives in terms of providing antenatal care and delivery. So you end up seeing quite a high number of risky births in most of these rural areas and actually having a high maternal mortality rate as well in the rural areas.
The midwives taking rural jobs are not leaving midwifery jobs in cities vacant.
These midwives are midwives that are unemployed and then also midwives that are retired but still able to provide services. And also midwives that have done basic midwifery course for 3 years, but they actually need to do a 1 year compulsory service to get their license.
Accoli says a year after the start of the pilot project, the program is bigger than ever. Millions of dollars in funding comes from the federal government's Oil Subsidy Reinvestment Fund.
We've actually signed a memorandum of understanding with each state government that they contribute to the pay of these midwives and then to contribute to finding accommodation for these midwives and basically generally looking after them and also begin to think of expanding beyond where we are now in their state.
She says midwives in the program are happy they're contributing to Nigeria's development. As for the pregnant women in their care, Dr. Accoli says they are much more likely to have a safe delivery for themselves and their babies. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
As spring planting goes into high gear in the United States, farmers are going high tech, using satellite-based GPS navigation systems in order to use less fertilizer, save money, and protect the environment. Steve Barragona has more.
On a weedy patch of land, an hour and a half from Washington, D.C., farmer Brad Eustace is tilling razor-straight lines with a GPS-guided tractor. With the computer in control, he barely has to steer.
You can do a straight line, a whole lot of engine.
The GPS computer receives signals from Earth-orbiting satellites to keep track of where his tractor is and where it has gone. Hoses deliver precise amounts of fertilizer right into the grooves that the tiller cuts. And when farmer Jimmy Messick comes back days or even weeks later with a GPS-guided corn planter,
the seed goes right on top of this tilled row. The corn planter will come back and it'll be putting the seeds exactly on top of these tilled strips that the machine has previously had put the fertilizer in.
Placing seed and fertilizer together with centimeter precision means fewer loads of fertilizer go on the fields.
You're able to use less, of course, you're saving the money. And you get the same performance out of the crop.
Messick says he's cut amounts of one fertilizer ingredient in half. On a 600-hectare farm, that saves him tens of thousands of dollars. And that's not all he's saving. Nutrients from farm fertilizers are a leading cause of water pollution, says Virginia Tech farming expert Tim Mize.
So if we get better at applying them only what's needed, where they're needed, then that's less nutrients that can move off and get into water systems or watersheds.
Jimmy Messick also uses GPS when he sprays weed killer. Before, he says, it was easier to miss spots or overlap.
If you weren't sure what had been done or what hadn't been done, with this system you can come back next week, next month, and you know what you sprayed and what you didn't spray.
GPS technology is guiding large-scale farm equipment across the country. And some harvesters also monitor how much crop is produced in each part of the field.
When you get an idea of, you know, where the productive areas of the field are, where the less productive areas, and then you fertilize accordingly.
With the price of fertilizers and fuel going up, along with the global demand for food, Mize says the name of the game today is getting the most crop with the least resources.
Anytime that you can reduce inputs and increase your bottom line, I mean, that's technology that everybody wants.
It's hands-free technology that's saving money and saving the environment. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Midland, Virginia.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the Internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
Researchers in Australia have simulated the impact of strong earthquakes on a 15-story model building to help improve design in seismically sensitive regions around the world. Scientists say it's the first time a trial of this size and detail has been conducted anywhere. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
For a few seconds, the earthquake that struck the Japanese city of Kobe in 1995 is recreated in a laboratory at the University of Technology, Sydney. A model 15-story building made of steel is subjected to the kind of trauma that killed thousands of people. Each floor is carefully monitored to see how they shift and buckle under the strain. Three other significant quakes have also been replicated, including the El Centro earthquake that struck California in 1940 and another in Hachinohe, Japan in 1968. The aim of the experiment is to test the response to earthquakes of office and apartment blocks built on soft soil, which researchers say can amplify seismic waves. Professor Bijan Somali says it's the only experiment of its kind to investigate how soil reacts under such intense pressure.
Soft soil, you can think of it as a layer of jelly, slab of jelly on a table. If you push the table a little bit, the top of jelly moves a lot more than the bottom of the jelly, isn't it? By having a building on top of a jelly, it will experience a lot more displacement and a lot more forces. So if that phenomenon is not taken into account in design stage, you might end up with a structure that would not survive. So this is certainly a safety issue.
Engineers in Australia are using what's called a shake table, where tons of soil and a replica tower block oscillate above a sophisticated hydraulic system. It's hoped the earthquake simulator will improve the resilience of buildings in seismically active regions, where homes and skyscrapers are constructed on soft clay and marshland. The research team says that in 2011, 20 earthquakes with magnitude 7 or above occurred around the world, causing more than 17,000 deaths. It's likely that some of the fatalities were in high-rise buildings built on soft soil. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
The Earth's south polar continent is covered with a layer of ice that averages more than 2 kilometers thick. A new study says Antarctica's ice shelves are being melted not by a warmer atmosphere above, but by warmer waters below. Roseanne Skirbel reports.
Hamish Pritchard is a glaciologist with the British Antarctic Survey. In 1993, and again in 2003, he observed the collapse of two ice shelves on the Antarctic Peninsula. He says the glaciers they had been holding back picked up speed and flowed 6 times faster than normal into the Southern Ocean.
And what we wanted to do was try to understand why that was.
Pritchard is lead author of the new study in the journal Nature. His research team used satellite laser instruments to measure changes in the Antarctic ice shelves between 2003 and 2008.
What we could see was that there was a distinct pattern in that some of the ice shelves were lowering quite strongly, and in particular those with the ice shelves in West Antarctica.
Previous studies looking for the causes of the shrinking ice shelves had ruled out decreased snowfall or any slowdown in the movement of glaciers toward the sea. Pritchard says the new data points to a process they call basal melt, warmer ocean water heating the ice shelf from below.
We looked at 54 ice shelves around Antarctica, and of those, 20 were thinning by this process. Going beyond that, we found that in every case where we saw this ice shelf thinning by basal melt, we also saw thinning by acceleration of the glaciers that drained from the ice sheet.
Pritchard says stronger westerly winds in the Southern Ocean are driving warmer ocean currents closer inland to ice shelves on the Antarctic coast.
It tells us that the ice shelves can be very sensitive to quite subtle changes in the climate, such as the wind patterns. That we hadn't really fully appreciated before.
Jean Gunnar Winter is the director of the Norwegian Polar Institute and not affiliated with the study. He says the research provides an important new insight into how climate change-induced melting of the Earth's polar ice sheets is affecting global sea levels.
Very many places around the world, most places where you have glaciers, and in Greenland, in parts of Antarctica, not in all of Antarctica, they add to the global sea level. and they may already be, from what we know, the most important explanation why we have an increased sea level.
Winter says emissions from fossil fuel combustion in our power plants, cars, and buildings continue to pump global warming gases into the atmosphere. As Pritchard and colleagues note in their Nature study, these warming trends are driving wind and ocean current changes that are speeding up the melting and thinning of Antarctic ice. That dynamic appears to be self-sustaining, the researchers warn, concluding that it may have already triggered a period of unstable glacier retreat across the western Antarctic ice sheet. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the Internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science. It's time once again for Science World's one-on-one segment. Last year, NASA created a buzz among scientists and non-scientists alike when they announced that their Kepler mission had found a planet some 600 light-years away that is enough like Earth that it could possibly support life, some say even human-like life. While there has always been a fascination with the possibility of intelligent life beyond our own planet, this discovery of what would become known as Kepler-22b put the imagination of people everywhere into hyperdrive, with many becoming even more convinced that, yes, it is quite possible that there is life somewhere out there. Modern efforts in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, or SETI, can be traced back to the inventor Nikola Tesla, who back in 1896 suggested that radio could be used to contact extraterrestrial life. Today, several scientific organizations, including the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California, use sophisticated technology, such as powerful radio telescopes, to search for intelligent forms of life somewhere out there in the cosmos. NASA's Kepler mission and the discovery of a number of extrasolar planets, or exoplanets, beyond our own solar system, has given groups like the SETI Institute a new focus in their work. To learn more about the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life, we recently spoke with Dr. Jill Tarter, an astronomer and director of the SETI Institute's Center for SETI Research. Dr. Tarter has devoted her career to search for signs of intelligent beings elsewhere. Dr. Tarter, I'd like to start with the obvious. Are we alone in the universe?
Actually, I don't know the answer to that question. That's what we're trying to do at the SETI Institute, to look for evidence of someone else's technology and thereby perhaps answer this old, old question.
If signs of life are found beyond Earth, what are you expecting to find?
Well, we at the SETI Institute have two types of scientists. We have a small team who works with me that's interested in finding intelligent life, and the rest of the SETI Institute who are astrobiologists. And they are fascinated by any kind of life, including microbial life. So my astrobiology colleagues will go looking for life in extraordinarily extreme environments on this planet to try and get a handle on how much habitable real estate there might be beyond the Earth. They will work on missions that will try and directly search for microbial life on other planets in this solar system, on the giant moons of some of those planets. But the folks who work on my team are more interested in mathematicians than microbes. And so we use large radio telescopes, and other SETI researchers use optical telescopes to try and find evidence of somebody else's technology out there. If we can see that technology across the vast distances between the stars, then we're going to infer that there were technologists that built that technology. We don't know if they're still there, but at least at one time there was intelligent life.
There's been a lot of excitement recently over the discovery of Earth-like exoplanets, and even there's been talk I've heard from scientists that at least one of them might be able to support human-like life.
The discovery of exoplanets has profoundly changed the way we do our business. In the past, we used our telescopes and we pointed them at stars. stars that we thought might be suitable hosts for planets that could have life. Now, it's a whole new ballgame because we know where those planets are. Kepler, the spacecraft, has discovered over 2,000 exoplanet candidates, and ground-based telescopes have found almost 1,000 other exoplanets. So we now know where to point our telescopes, and we know we're pointing at a planetary system. And since life as we know it is a planetary phenomenon, we think this is a good place to look.
Dr. Tarter, I recently wrote a piece for my blog about a study by two Princeton researchers, Edwin Turner and David Spiegel. In their research, they basically say that our expectation of finding extraterrestrial life may be more based in optimism rather than scientific fact, and that there was very little supporting scientific evidence that life exists or could exist beyond our own planet. Are you familiar with this study?
I am familiar with it, and I would also make the claim that there is also very little evidence that it doesn't. We are actually out of evidence on either side of the argument. And I go back to what Philip Morrison and Giuseppe Cocconi said in the last sentence of the very first paper in a scientific journal on SETI. And they said the probability of success is difficult to estimate, but if we never search, the chance of success is zero. So I don't think there's anyone who would tell you we should spend all of our scientific research working on SETI. But it is such an important question that it is worth investing systematically and over the long haul a small amount to try and answer this old question. Indeed, everything that we have learned over the past few decades tells us that life, in fact, could be more prevalent than we once might have thought. We've become aware of what we call extremophiles, primarily microbial life on this planet, which lives in conditions that, when I was a student, would have been laughed at. Of course nothing can live there, we would have said, but in fact it does. So that might translate into more habitable or potentially habitable real estate out there. We've also now learned that planets are abundant. They're not just a good theory, but in fact they are a fact. And we haven't yet quite found Earth 2.0, although you kind of alluded to it before. We're not quite there yet, but we can almost taste it. It seems that it's, from what we now know, quite inevitable that there will be Earth analogs out there. And so I think that the combination of extremophiles giving the microbes the respect they really do deserve and exoplanets make the universe appear more biofriendly than we once might have guessed. It doesn't mean that it is. We don't have any data. That's what we're trying to find. We will explore other bodies in our own solar system, looking for evidence of extant or extinct life, and we are now searching with our telescopes for extraterrestrial technologies, and in the future we will design and build more complicated, complex spacecraft that will be able to image planets like the Earth in orbit around nearby stars and do a chemical assay of their atmospheres to look for chemical disequilibrium that might indicate a biosphere on the surface of the planet, just as Earth's atmosphere indicates a robust biology on the surface of our planet. So we might be able to, with advanced equipment, come to a similar conclusion about another world out there. But at the moment, we don't know, and I think it's worth trying to find out.
That was Dr. Jill Tarter, an astronomer and director of the SETI Institute's Center for SETI Research in Mountain View, California. Dr. Tarter also wanted me to pass along to you her invitation to try out the SETI Institute's new citizen science project called SETI Live. You can find it on the Internet at SETILive.org. That's SETILIVE.org. You can hear an expanded version of our interview with Dr. Tarter on our web and blog site at voanews.com/science. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. You'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the Internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.